In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of poet, author, educator, and community builder Gwendolyn Brooks, who was born in Topeka, Kansas. She moved to Chicago at just a few weeks old, where she remained an integral figure in the city for the rest of her life. Her work often dealt with the personal celebrations and struggles of ordinary people in her community. Miss Brooks once wrote, "If you wanted a poem, all you had to do was look out of a window. There was material always, walking or running, fighting or screaming or singing." Her list of accolades is rightfully long, including the 1950 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for Annie Allen, making her the first African-American to receive a Pulitzer Prize. However, Miss Brooks's legacy goes far beyond awards, and today we are joined by three writers and educators from Chicago who know Miss Brooks's impact firsthand. For this episode, we are pleased to welcome award-winning writer, scholar, and cultural organizer Dr. Eve L. Ewing, award-winning writer, editor, and educator Nate Marshall, and educator, author, and legacy keeper Nora Brooks Blakely, who manages Brooks Permissions and is the daughter of Gwendolyn Brooks. You can find more in-depth biographies of our guests in the episode description. Eve, Nate, and Nora are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place April 25th, 2023, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you all for joining me, Nora, Nate, and Eve. It's nice to have you here on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm excited to get into Gwendolyn Brooks with you all. I think this is our most Chicago podcast yet to date.
Yeah, buddy.
So this will be good. I guess I'll start off, if y'all don't mind, just sharing a little bit about yourselves, what you've been up to in your connection to Gwendolyn Brooks. Eve, would you like to get going?
Sure. I'll start us off. I'll be the sacrificial poet, as we used to say. What I've been up to these days, I am finishing a manuscript, wrapped up a manuscript for my next nonfiction book, which is about anti-Blackness and anti-Indigeneity in public schools. So I have to hopefully hop back on the podcast when that comes out and talk about it some more. And I am currently writing the Black Panther comic book series, which is pretty fun. That's like my fourth or fifth project for Marvel. I'm not good at counting that right now, but I feel like it's exciting to move into more of like a, you know, kind of legacy character space on the comic side. And then I'm also working a little bit, nibbling away at my next poetry collection, which is a collection of silly and fun poems for young people. So that's all fun and good stuff. I also like to, you know, chase Nate around and chase Nora around and try to get them to hang out with me at different times. They're both super cool people that I love being around. And in terms of my connection to Gwendolyn Brooks, like countless school children in Chicago, I first came to Brooks through the Pool Player 7 at the Golden Shovel, We Real Cool, probably when I was about 8 years old. I remember reading that poem in school. But when I was in college, got to dive more deeply into her work and really changed my life with getting to know the incredible breadth and span of her long career. And I think what blew me away in my young adulthood was number one, how often she continued to reinvent herself and shift and change over the duration of her career. That was very inspiring. I came to realize that the Brooks I had met as a child was but one of many. And that was very inspiring. And then the other thing about her that, you know, really transformed my life forever was her enactment of the poet as a person in the world who is deeply engaged in community and deeply involved in community. And so that is kind of how I came to know her work initially. And I feel like her work and her legacy continues to give, and that I haven't hit bottom yet on things I can learn. And then I was also blessed enough to be able to co-write a play about her life with Nate, which we can talk about more. That's my Brooks biography.
That's great. Thank you, Eve. I do want to talk about the play as well. But Nate, let's get to you first. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your connection to Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yeah, absolutely. What's up? So I'm Nate Marshall. I'm a writer and a teacher. And I'm working on, I guess, the next book of poems right now and a couple other projects very slowly. But in terms of my connection to Miss Brooks, certainly me and Eve co-wrote the play No Blue Memories, which was really a joy. And I'm trying to think about Surely the first Brooks poem that I read was We Real Cool. But I think the first one that really like grabbed me sort of by like the collar of my shirt for real was Beverly Hills, Chicago. Because it was the first time I really read a poem where I was like, oh, this poem is like about a place that I like know, that I like drive through. Like it was, I think the first time that I ever had the experience of reading a piece of literature that mirrored an experience I had had, and it had kind of consistent, that had been kind of like a central experience in my life. Cause I went to, I'm from like the far south side of Chicago. And so I would drive through the neighborhood of Beverly on the school bus every day going to school. And it felt, I was like, yo, is this lady in my head? Like, what is going on? This is miraculous and terrifying. And sort of from then, I think really kind of became a devotee and, you know, read all the work, have taught courses on Brooks. Yeah, just a deep lover of Miss Brooks' work.
Thank you for that, Nate. And Nora, how about you?
Well, Nora Brooks Blakely. And I should first explain that because people think my name is hyphenated and it is not. My mother decided that if my father could name my brother after him, that the least she could do was to put part of her name in mine. So my middle name is actually Brooks, which I now describe to people as that I was born as a feminist statement. So so that's the beginning. I currently, as far as what I'm doing as an artist, I divide myself into two. There's legacy woman, which is the person who handles all the things connected with Gwendolyn Brooks. And then I don't really have a name for the other me, but that's the one who writes plays and musicals for young people and who also put out my first children's book a couple of years ago, Moyenda and the Golden Heart. And I am now in my third year of a 5-year plan for world domination by Moyenda. And this year doing a pack of principles, which is a seven workbook series that will be coloring activity books for each of the seven principles of Kwanzaa. And on the other side is Legacy Woman. This is the 70th anniversary of the publication of Maud Martha. And we are doing some things, you know, so with Brooks for Missions, which I'll be happy to talk about more later if there's time, et cetera. So how I met Gwendolyn Brooks, I met her in a hospital when I was born. And but I continued to re-meet her over the years, meeting her as a mother of me as a young school child that took me around to a lot of different experiences that I otherwise never would have had. Meeting her again, more in the artistic world, dancing and writing and so forth as an adult, and many places in between, but also meeting her again after she passed, because, you know, even if your mother's a great poet, she's still your mother. So it's like, yeah, you know, that person over there. But rereading Maud Martha after she died was a signal experience where I started thinking about different possible limbs that I would be willing to give up to be able to write like that. So yes, that is a small group of the me and Gwendolyn Brooks meetings.
Fantastic. That's great. You all mentioned kind of, and Eve, you brought it up, how Gwendolyn first made you realize the poet as a person in the world. And you all mentioned you all have kind of different selves of yourself out there, educators, poets, writers, you know, legacy keepers, if you will. What about Gwendolyn's career, both, you know, writing, but also as a community builder, specifically, have you learned from or tried to emulate? Nora, perhaps you'd like to start on that one.
Yes, because it wasn't just as a writer, although anybody who reads my writing and sees the litter of alliteration that just flows through my work knows immediately that that it's an infection I caught from my mother. I am addicted to alliteration. There it goes again. Also, just as the period of time that I grew up in where young women were trying to figure out if they were going to go to college, whether they would work or not. And these were never questions for me. I grew up in a house where I had an outdoors mother. You know, she was out in the world. She took trains to places to work. She would, you know, come back. She would send me clippings while she was gone. She would work at the dining room table. She would write notes to herself on the marble top nightstand in the bedroom, you know. So very early, I had the understanding that you could pretty much be what you defined yourself to be, which for somebody who, a female that grew up in the 50s and 60s and early 70s was pretty doggone miraculous. And that you could also be that not only could you be what you defined yourself to be, but you could be that anywhere. There wasn't a set place, a set home, or a set room that you had to have to create. You could be creative anywhere you were. And she had notepads in her purses that she would whip out and write things down on. At the University of Illinois, the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, where her archives are now, there are probably about, I think, 150, a couple of hundred or something of these little notebooks that she had, where she would carry them around and write everything. From what she ate that day, to things that inspired her on television, to something that caught her in one of her beloved soap operas, to an idea she had for a poem, a book, whatever. And it's all in these little tiny books. So you could be what you wanted, where you wanted.
I love that. Just picture her on the L, jotting down something. That's great. Nate Neve, how about you? In what ways have you tried to, be a poet in the world and know that it's more than just words, right? It's how you carry yourself and communities you tried to build. What have you learned from Gwendolyn in that regard?
I can start. One loving and gentle correction is that we don't say Gwendolyn because, you know, in I think part of this is in the Black community, the history of Black elders being called by their first names by people younger than them. But I think also for her stature in particular, right, I think one of the it is our habit to refer to Miss Brooks.
Thank you for
and
that.
So, yeah, that is a loving invitation into a cultural practice. I think for me, I wrote my undergraduate bachelor's thesis about Gwendolyn Brooks. And one of the things that impressed me was reading her first autobiography, which is called Report from Part One. And one of the things she talks about is her experience at the Fisk Writers Conference. And this was in 1967. And the thing about Miss Brooks is we associate her quite rightly with the Black arts movement, but she was generationally, a generation above a lot of the folks that were her artistic contemporaries in the Black arts movement. She had already had a very successful career for two decades, had already won a Pulitzer Prize. And yet when she writes about attending that conference, when she writes about interfacing with the other poets of the Black arts movement, her willingness to learn and her devotion to an ongoing practice of learning from young people and recognizing on the one hand her institutional power and institutional access and access of prestige and trying to use that to leverage opportunities for other people. So it's not like in that regard, she understood herself as not being their peer, right? But artistically and as a learner, seeing herself as the peer of much younger writers, I think is something that I think is a practice that I have tried to continue and to always have an orientation as a learner. I think that this also has to do with the way me and Nate were raised in the performance and slam and spoken word community in Chicago, which is that there's like a lot of vertical relationships. So I think for me, like trying to have that orientation as a learner in space. And then the other thing is, as part of that project, I was fortunate enough to interact with some of her archives that were at Berkeley. I didn't get to see the Illinois archives until much later when we were working on the play, but some of her papers that are at Berkeley, and just the sheer breadth of the correspondence was so inspiring. And realizing that after this poet had published so many successful books, had won so many incredible prizes, had gotten all this national attention, what she was actually doing on a day-to-day basis was just like talking to regular people and spending a lot of time showing up and being in regular space. And there are so many letters and cards and recollections from people that are like, you know, you visited my school and, you know, I saw you at this place, or I saw you do this reading. And I think that that for me really shaped my understanding that, you know, to quote the Sesame Street song, like the writer is a person in your neighborhood, right? The poet is a person in your neighborhood. And I see the work of, and that's very different from an image of a poet or a writer as someone who like sits in a, you know, I don't know, like an office or a garret in Paris or something, an attic or a, you know, and sits there like staring at their typewriter, occasionally, you know, pausing only to look longingly out the window and contemplate the depth of their thoughts, waiting for the muses to come, you know. And then like, I remember I got to visit Ernest Hemingway's house in Key West, and they're like, this is the room where every day he would walk in. It's like a beautiful office. And they're like, and then someone would bring him his breakfast on a tray at this time, you know. And I think that that's for a lot of people, the image of what they think a writer is. And I think in particular, the image of what they think a poet is. And This is an image, her legacy gives us an image of a poet as a person who shows up to work. And showing up to work includes making time and space for lots of different people and being available, being visible, being responsive to them. And so, you know, for me, that looks sometimes like big projects, things that Nate and I have co-organized, like the Chicago Poetry Block Party or the Emerging Poets Incubator or the play or other types of community work that we've both been involved in. But for me, it also means, you know, I'm always hesitant to say this publicly because I only got so many hours in a day. But like, you know, if people ask me, hey, can you come to my school? COVID has altered my considerations about this a little bit, but like more often than not, I'm going to be there in Chicago. Right. And you know, if people want me to come to an event or donate books or come talk to young people, that's just something, you know, letters, like those types of things are just things that I try really hard to make time for. Nate has lovingly reminded me that Miss Brooks was doing all this in an era before email. And so some of the level of accessibility and demand, because I felt a lot of guilt around not being able to show up at the same level or respond to every single person or show up for every single request. A lot of times I can't. I'm very tired and overwhelmed. But, you know, electronic communications has changed that a little bit. But I think I really see poetry work as out and about work, not in the crib thinking about things by yourself work. It helps that I'm an extrovert, and I recognize that this is not everybody's ministry. And if you want to be the type of writer who just sits in a room and writes stuff, that is great. And that is your right. It's just not my jam. And very grateful that Miss Brooks kind of gave us the pathway to seeing a different type of writing life.
If I could interrupt for a second, I think it's important to remember that Mama was actually both of those, because when she was out, she was out. And she would stay at a reading until every last person that had a question to ask had asked that question. And she was definitely that person. She went to a school where, I still remember this, where she signed over 400 autographs, because she signed one for every child at the school. Even if I wanted to do that, my hands would say, "What are you doing?" They would just, and they would turn into little, you know, things. But she was also the person that over the holidays in the winter and in the summer from June to September, virtually did not come out of her house. to the point, and that's not hyperbole. My friend and co-administrator of Brooks and Missions, Cynthia Walls, and I would get her grocery list and go and get groceries because she wasn't coming outside. She was perfectly happy to be in that house or apartment when she moved to the apartment and not leave for months at a time. So I think Eve, so don't beat yourself up because she, even before email, and remember when email was supposed to be the answer to this problem? But even before email, you know, she answered all those letters, but she also defined space where this is my space,
yeah,
and you're not treading on this. So be at ease. Yeah.
No, I love that. I think there was one thing I remember when we were working on the play, and we got to spend some time in the archives down at University of Illinois, where she sort of wrote about this in a letter, like someone was making some request of her. And I always remember it because it's like aspirational for me, where she's like, look, she's like, during these months, like these 9 months out of the year, I'm for the world. But these 3 months, like the summer, is just me. Like, it's just me. And I was like, dang, I what a champion. What a hero. yeah. You know, I think Eve spoke really eloquently about the ways that Brooke's orientation to the world and orientation sort of to the community has shaped her. And I don't want to repeat that because I feel like for me, it's sort of similar. I would echo a lot of her sentiments. One thing that was, I think, important for me in terms of my work and in terms of my engagement with Brooks was, I mean, just literally seeing that regular people, regular places, places that I literally knew that were not places considered particularly beautiful or intellectual or wealthy or whatever, could be accorded with the beauty of poetry was for me a transformative experience as a young person, as someone like coming into what would become a life of writing. And I truly don't know, like so much of my work is rooted in Chicago, is rooted in Black communities broadly conceived and sort of Black experience broadly conceived. And I simply don't know that I would have had the confidence or the inclination to write in those ways had there not been a Brooks, right? Had there not been, Miss Brooks writing about a street in Bronzeville, I don't know that it would have occurred to me or felt appropriate to like write about Harold's Chicken Shack on 103rd. So for me, that's been sort of everything.
I love that. Yeah, like the, she kind of opened doors for you all. And you mentioned the Black Arts Movement. And I want to talk to you, Nate, too, about our exhibit at the American Writers Museum, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, which you were part of the curating team. A part of that exhibit is a bit of a deep dive into Miss Brooks's poem Riot. And so I'm curious if you, Nate, can sort of contextualize that poem and its placement within the exhibit and why you felt as a curating team it was important to include that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, I think when we were doing that advisory work, we weren't, I don't know that we were necessarily thinking about sort of specific exhibits and how they would be, you know, how it would be kind of designed, what things would be on display, that kind of stuff. But I think we talked about sort of what are the threads that are important and what, if any, particular pieces or particular people were important as kind of cornerstones or foundations. And, you know, and for me, I think it's like really not hyperbolic to say, you know, if I'm thinking about the sort of history of African-American poetry and how that intersects with thinking about sort of protest or resistance. You know, I think there are very, very few poems that for me stand as kind of deep canon in that, right? Maybe the most well-known or one of the most well-known is like, If We Must Die, right? Claude McKay, right? But for me, like standing, you know, eye to eye with that poem is Riot, right? Especially when we're thinking about the sort of Black freedom struggle in the 1960s into the 70s, and that kind of pivotal moment where you see unrest in these cities, you see both the kind of flourishing and this sort of complicating or fracturing of the sort of civil rights dream with the assassinations of Malcolm and Martin and Medgar Evers and all these people. I don't think there's a better poem or a poem that more truly captures the political tenor of that time, right? And so for me, it's such a no-brainer. Like, it's such a it's such a necessity to pay some tribute to that work. And because it's work, like to our sort of earlier points about Miss Brooks, right? I think it's work that is deeply informed by being someone who is really enmeshed in community, right? Someone who is having conversations with young people who are really on the sort of leading edge of what is happening politically in that moment. And so, you know, it's not this poem that comes from someone who's sort of disconnected or kind of watching this thing at a remove, but someone who's just really in community with people. And I think that's so meaningful, and it comes through in the work.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Eve said, she wasn't up there in her spire, just, you know, writing away. Yeah. She was actually with everyone. And what ways does that community come through in that poem specifically, but just in her work in general?
Yeah. For me, the greatest encapsulation of this is actually like the words that Miss Brooks says herself. Probably the most famous or most iconic recording of Miss Brooks' most iconic poem, We Real Cool. She has a sort of little intro to it, which is funny because she kind of throws a little bit of shade about people's like devotion to that singular poem is encapsulating all of her legacy. But once she's done like getting her jokes off, she says this thing about that I really love about it, about the formation of that poem. And she's like, I was walking through my community. I saw these boys in the pool hall and I thought, what might they think about themselves? Right. And so for me, like, this is the foundational impulse. I think it's the impulse that one sees in Riot. And in Riot, you have this sort of like dialogue or dialectic. I don't mean to sound like a professor, but sorry, it's the game. Between like the sort of white philosopher, Black philosopher, right? You have this sort of this engagement, but like one of the things that I find staggering about that poem and about Miss Brooks' work in general is she really does not judge people. She really takes people on their own terms and tries to always do that work of what she said is to think about how they might feel about themselves. And I think that is such deep, empathetic and important work. And especially, you know, I think in a current political moment where in so many ways we're not thinking about each other and how each other feel or how each other might relate to subjects that we feel differently about. Yeah, just work that has that kind of heart is so necessary to me.
Yeah, well said indeed. Yeah, and you know, you bring up an interesting point. One thing I do like to ask in these, even though it's pure conjecture, we don't really know, but so you mentioned our current world and climate. How do you think Miss Brooks would be engaging in our current world? If, you know, I mean, we're approaching the months where, you know, she would be inside, not engaging, but I'm just curious that, you know, Nora, perhaps you could speak to this, especially in the, and we mentioned, you know, this is the age of email. You know, Miss Brooks wasn't working around that time as much. I'm just curious if you think, you know, have any ideas as to how she'd be engaging in our current, you know, world and all of its ills.
She would be so thoroughly engaged. She, I think about her poem, Boy Breaking Glass, where, you know, where she talks about, yeah, if I cannot, and my brain is blanking now, I will create a hole. And I thought about that when all of the people were on television yelling about the thugs that needed to be beaten down and flung into prison cells. And there were definitely among the kids who were out there, definitely some who probably needed to go to jail. But a lot of the kids were kids who were just hanging out, and possibly in numbers it scared some people, but they were fundamentally hanging out because there weren't a lot of other places to go and a lot of other things to do, and addressing how that needs to be remedied. And I think the mission statement for Brooks and Missions is demonstrate her continuing relevance in the 21st century and beyond. And when you look at pieces like that, you look at Patrick Bowie of Cabrini Green, which is about a young child, our sparkle of influence interrupted, as she says, and you think about all of these kids, in fact, including when I was teaching one of my students who was shot down on the streets, and you think about all of these kids whose sparkle of influence has been interrupted. You look at the pieces, thinking of Elizabeth Steinberg, about child abuse, of Near Johannesburg Boy, about what was happening with apartheid, and an old Black woman homeless and indistinct. I mean, these are all pieces that very sadly, 40, 50 years after they were written, in some cases more, are still speaking to exactly what is going on in the world. In Speech to the Young, Speech to the Progress Toward, there's a line in there that people have come up to me when I'm doing speeches or whatever, and they say how much that has gotten them through. And that is, even if you are not ready for day, it cannot always be night. And I see E's mouth moving, because everybody that hears that poem hangs on to that line, you know, those lines, like they are like they're the line coming down from a helicopter to pull you out of a flood, you know. And one person told me, a young woman, that she didn't know if she would have made it through college. And I don't mean would have quit. She was talking about suicide. But if it had not been for those lines. And there's just so many pieces of hers. I'm going to scramble around and try to find one that I'm always quoting. So I'm going to try to find that while other people are talking. And of course, the Paul Robeson poem, which I am trying to replace We Real Cool, trying to replace We Real Cool with the Paul Robeson poem, because it ends in those important three lines, you know, we are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. Now Nate's mouthing with me. We are each other's magnitude and bond. And I think that all of those are things that we need to keep at the forefront of our brains, as both Eve and Nate were saying, in times like these, that these are the things that move us forward, that inspire us, that give us a goalpost to reach toward and a standing pole to hang on to. You know, so not that I feel strongly about this or anything, but so talk about yourself. I'm going to look for that piece I wanted to quote.
That was fantastic. That answers one of my questions, which is, you know, why should folks read Gwendolyn Brooks today? And that's it. You know, her work's still so powerful and unfortunately relevant. But Nate and Eve, as educators yourselves, what do you say to young folks who haven't read Gwendolyn Brooks yet when you introduce her work to them? How do you, what do you say?
You know, Nate, every once in a while drops a bar, don't let his head get too big, but he said something to me many, many years ago. He said it, I kind of offhandedly, like a decade ago. And I've quoted it so many times since then. He knows what it's going to be. But he said the greatest thing a poem or a poet can give is permission. And Brooks has been a poet who has given us all permission to do so much. You know, what Nate mentioned about just being able to write a poem about the place where you live gives us permission. And I think that that simple fact is why she has remained a touchstone for so many educators in particular, because for every young person, no matter where you come from, no matter where you are, starting by saying, let's tell your story, right? And your story can be big. It can be a capital S story. It can be small. It can be funny. But, you know, the work of a poet is to look closely at life's small moments and to kind of magnify them. And that's something that anybody can do. And I think that her poems exemplify that so much. So that, you know, one of the most cliched pieces of advice in writing, but it's one I return to over and over because it's true, is show, don't tell. And so for me, in terms of introducing, you know, young writers to Brooks, I'm really not interested in being like, and she won this and she did this and she had this acclaim and she did this, that, and the other thing, but actually just bring in the work. The work speaks for itself, and the work serves as so profound an invitation to tell your own story in your own way. So I think that that is why, and as we've already discussed, there is such a multiplicity of Brooks's, right? That there's a poem for everything and there's a poem for every writer. For me, you know, we haven't talked so much about Annie Allen, but the Aeneid, which is, you know, a long form epic poem from that collection, Annie Allen, is that's a poem that changed my life. It changed my life because I didn't understand it at all. I didn't know what she was talking about. I was so confused and I was so intrigued and excited that I was what I would call productively confused. I became sort of obsessed in being able to understand this puzzle and unlock it. And so, you know, in such an amazing career and life, there's something for everybody. The one other thing I'll say about your earlier question about like, what would she be doing today? Certainly I can't have too much longing about this because, you know, she would be 106 years old and everybody deserves rest. And so I can't be wistful like, oh, I wish she was writing today. That being said, I sort of do. And the reason I say that is because I believe that she was a poet of constant reinvention. And I think that there is a Brooks, there would be a different Brooks writing now. It wouldn't just be, you know, these are my old bangers and I'm going to keep like bringing back the old classic poems everybody loves that speak to this moment, though they certainly do. She would still be writing new stuff, and she would be writing new stuff inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement. And she would be writing new stuff inspired by, you know, other cataclysmic changes in the world and COVID and mutual aid. And, you know, all of those things would transform her. And so I can say, I don't think we ever met that Brooks, right? And that if she lived another 100 years, she'd be three other different poets. And I just think that's really cool. And, you know, she was not someone who was content to kind of rest on her laurels and stay in place. And I love that.
I want to use what Eve just said as an excuse to do two quotes, because she said, show, don't tell. And so... she wrote and especially that whole thing of reinventing herself, because people get into arguments about pre-67 Gwendolyn Brooks and post-67 Gwendolyn Brooks, and some people drive me crazy because they say, you know, that after 67 her poetry was just so angry. And if you say that, then clearly you haven't read her pre-67 poetry, because if you look at poems like Riders to the Blood Red Bath, she was angry. And stuff. So there's that. But two quotes. One is from post-67, and it's her poem to Jane Addams. And this quote from it, because I describe this poem as an accidental autobiography. I think there are things in here that actually Mama was telling us about herself without perhaps even being aware of it. And this quote is, "I shall tell you a thing about giants that you do not wish to know. Giants look in mirrors and see almost nothing at all. But they leave their houses nevertheless, They lurch out of doors to reach you, the other stretchers and strainers. Erased under ermine or loud in tatters, oh, moneyed or mashed, you matter. You matter. And giants must bother. And so that was one. And it speaks to, I know, girl, right? Talking to you.
I said, people, listen, I'm snapping and testifying off mic.
And it speaks to what Eve was saying earlier about her commitment to coming outside and being, you know, and being part of that. But the other is the one that I referenced that I was looking for, because I find it fascinating that this comes from Annie Allen. In fact, it's the closing lines. It's something that could have been written 10 years ago, 4 years ago, last night. And it is, rise, let us combine. There are no magics or elves or timely godmothers to guide us. We are lost, must wizard a track through our own screaming weed. And that's what you tell kids, because I'm a former teacher too. That's what you tell kids when you're talking about why you need to read Gwendolyn Brooks. You just start quoting lines that they know, that, like Nate said, when he was like, are you in my head? you know, that will make them go, oh, wait a minute. You know, that speaks to me. That speaks to me. And I'm talking too much. I'm going to shut up. But one quick last thing. We were doing a production, a group of people that I gathered together called Aurora Performance Group. And we were doing a piece where it was supposed to be college kids having to do a research paper on Mama. And so they were reading all of this poetry and everything as they were doing the research assignment. And so we did this for some fifth and sixth graders who were not excited about the idea. They had been left to school off of a trip because they had been bad. And so they did not want to sit in this auditorium and listen to this stupid thing. And so I watched them move from sitting still back in their seats, like, yeah, do something, you know, to moving forward and leaning in. And afterwards, we asked them to talk about some of the different things. And between The Life of Lincoln West, which talks about identity, and Kojo, a later poem, I Am a Black, which talks about identity, one of the kids raised his hand and said, I realized that I had rights, that I had as many rights as white people. And it just ripped out my heart. It invigorated me, because it's like, oh, we're doing what we need to be doing. But it also just ripped out my heart that he had gotten to fifth or sixth grade feeling that there were sets of rights for some people in the country and other sets of rights for other people in the country, and that he didn't have anything to say about that, that there was absolutely nothing he could do about that. That's just the way it was. So, yes. Okay, shutting up now.
No, that's not a great story of the power of Miss Brooks' words. I don't know what it is. That's yeah, that's fantastic. And speaking of performance, I did, Eve and Nate, I do want to, before we run out of time, hear a little bit about No Blue Memories, and I hear it's being restaged.
Yeah, so in some year of the recent past, 2016, 2017. Yeah. So at some point, that isn't today. We were the Poetry Foundation, and I tell this story not to kind of belabor, not to be TMI, but because I think it's actually exemplary of something. So the Poetry Foundation approached a collective called Manual Cinema, which does really remarkable shadow puppet poetry with live action accompanying it. It's very weird. It's hard to describe. Rock with me. We'll keep it going. So the Poetry Foundation reached out to them and said, hey, would you like to do something about Gwendolyn Brooks? And they said, we would love to, but we don't think we're the right people to write that. But we know this person we went to college with, Eve Ewing. Have you ever heard of her? And the Poetry Foundation was like, yeah, we heard of her. She's decent. And so, so they said, will you write this thing? And I said, well, I would love to write it. But if I write it, I really have to co-write it with my friend, Nate Marshall. And Nate said, well, I would love to co-write this with you. But if we're going to do that, we really need to have our friend Jamila Woods do the music. And Jamila said, I would love to do the music. But, you know, my sister, Ayanna Woods, is really the composer. And Ayanna said, OK. And so then... And so what the show is a touring, and this is, it's being remounted in Chicago for the first time in a few years, but it has toured in the last several years, which is amazing. It is a live shadow puppets cast with an overhead projector alongside actors who are performing with poetry and live original music on stage, extravaganza. It is one of my favorite reviews when it first came out, which I believe was from Chicago Magazine, was like a performance so weird and innovative. It's hard to describe. Like every review was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And I don't know how to tell you what it is. So people just need to see it. It's really dope. And the reason I tell that convoluted story is because it's exemplary of the type of ethos that I think we inherited from the legacy of Miss Brooks, right? Which is like, I want to do the thing, but it's not really about me doing the thing, right? I want to do it with the people I love. And the show is one of the coolest things I've ever gotten to be a part of, because Nate and I got to dwell in the immeasurable talents of other people who do stuff that we kind of don't get and don't know how to do at all. We can't act. We can't, you know, we're not great at the puppetry, the music. We're not music. I mean, actually Nate does make music, but I don't. And so like, It's such a joyous, raucous, fun show that reflects a lot of people having a great time, like kind of jamming together. And I think that is really special. But what's also been great is that the first time it went up at the Harold Washington Library, there was a line. It was bad weather, and there was a line around the block of people going in to see the show. And everybody was like getting snowed on and hailed on and whatnot. And everyone was so happy. And they were all, everybody was talking about like their favorite Gwendolyn Brooks memories, right? And so many people were like, and she came to my school and I read this thing and this one time and I was at the library and da 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 da. And it was so magical. And I truly feel, you know, that her spirit has graced us in that space through that collective memory. So yeah, the show will be back at the Harold Washington Library.
We'll have a link in the
description. Okay. Yeah. So, there will be two public performances, May 16th, which is a Tuesday, and Thursday, May 18th, at 6 PM. It is free. It is first come, first serve. Wear a mask, come ready to dance and have a good time and wiggle around in your seat, feeling happy thoughts. And yeah, it's really dope. And then additionally, those are the public performances, but of course we have, performances that are just for school groups, and folks can reach out to the Poetry Foundation if they're interested in that. Which is also, you know, very much an extension of the kind of community work that we're interested in doing. We just want to make a cool show that's a lot of fun and have it be free at the library. And, you know, side note is that the Harold Washington Library is also very important to both of us as a space. And so it's very special that it's there. And yeah, excited to have it be back up.
And speaking of the Poetry Foundation and speaking of Eve and Nate, they're hiding another light of theirs under the barrel. AWM, Nate, if you have not seen their presentation of We Real Cool, the 5-minute animated kick butt piece that whole same team, and I loved that whole green grass grew all around version of how everybody got together. If you have not seen that, run, don't walk to YouTube and pull it up. And if you just put in Poetry Foundation, We Real Cool, you will find it. It is awesome.
I'm gonna do that right after this, that's for sure.
Thank you, Nora.
So yes.
Yeah, and I before we wrap this up, I apologize for forgetting which you know, which is the anniversary this year. I'm still working on my coffee this morning, but what does Brooks Permissions have planned this year?
Brooks Permissions, basically it's we're wrapping up National Poetry Month. And one of the things you'll see in the next day or two to close out is an encouragement for people to look at our book that we put out during the centennial seasons, The Gwendolyn Brooks Experience, because we're going to share poems that are not the best known of mamas, that we suggest the challenge that people read at least one new poem a day by Gwendolyn Brooks over this closing weekend of National Poetry Month. So there's that. Also, I am so excited to be able to say that sometimes you have dreams and they come true. We're doing, for her birthday, June 7th, we're doing one of our GB7s. That's a too long a story to go into. Just say GB7, it happens. And it is, and both Nate and Eve have been kind enough to be part and parcel of that. But we're doing a presentation on Maud Martha. And it is a panel of three different female writers and educators who are going to look at Maud Martha from different points of view. So it'll be the novelist Sandra Jackson Opoku, who's going to look at Maud Martha in the context of the times that it came out in. It's going to be Joanne Gabin, founder and director of the Furious Flower Literary Center and educator and writer as well, who's going to be looking at the impact of Maud Martha, not only at the time, but how it continues to impact and speak to the current culture. And we are going to have Sandra says a look at, I asked her to look at writers enfolding their communities. And she's going to compare Maud Martha to House on Mango Street. And I cannot tell you how geeked I am about this. June 7th, 7 p.m., GB7. And you can see it on our streaming platforms on YouTube and Facebook. So if people want to keep track of what's going on, they can also hang out at our Brooks Permissions Facebook page, where you can get all the, as I very badly said recently, all the skinny on Gwenny. So yeah, so yay.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all. Is there anything else anyone wanted to say before we wrap it up? About Miss Brooks or anything else?
I want to do one other real quick shout out. Gwendolyn Brooks, part of her legacy was as the Illinois Poet Laureate. And I feel very excited that another poet who is not here, but is very much here in spirit in this conversation, just got announced as Chicago's very first Poet Laureate. And that is our uncle, Avery R. Young, in the place to be. And I just want to bring his name into this conversation because he is one of the most Brooksian people around, as Absolutely. Far as I'm concerned, and has mentored so many people, has taught us so many much. So has taught us so much and is the community poet's community poet. All your favorite poets were mentored by Avery. And so if folks don't know his work and if you are inspired by this and you're thinking, who is a Brooks of our time who's here right now? First of all, Brooks is still the Brooks of our time, but you know, in the same way, nothing is the new black, nothing is the new Brooks, but a Brooksian poet to uplift. Avery R. Young, please check out his book, Neckbone, and he's going to be doing amazing things as the brand new Poet Laureate of Chicago. So very proud, very proud.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, on that note as well, just much love and respect to Angela Jackson, the current Illinois State Poet Laureate, who is also, you know, a student of Brooks, both in the spiritual and the literal sense, and very much upholding that legacy as well.
Great.
And if you haven't heard it already, you probably will have heard it by the time you hear this, and that is that a major announcement is coming out from the Poetry Foundation that I can't say anything else about.
All right. Well, thank you, Nora. Thank you, Eve. Thank you, Nate. I've had a pleasure talking with you all, and thanks for taking the time to do this with me.
Thanks for letting us talk. We just like to be around each other.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Nate.
Thanks, y'all. Have a good day.
What a wonderful excuse. Peace.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.